Robert Young is in the studio to speak with Fresh Air's co-producer, Danny Miller.
Thanks, Terry. Robert M. Young's films, which include Nothing But a Man, Short Eyes, One Trick Pony, and The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez, tend to be about the lives of minorities, oppressed, or disenfranchised people. Nothing But a Man, which starred Ivan Dixon and Abby Lincoln, was about a young black couple contending with the dangers and frustrations of racism in the South during the early 60s. Short Eyes, which is prison slang for child molester, examines the racially mixed and tense prison life in the Tombs Prison in New York, and his latest film, The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez, is a true story about a young Mexican who shoots a Texas sheriff in self-defense and eludes a bloodthirsty posse for 11 days, thereby becoming a regional legend which persists to this day. Most of his films are either based on true stories or are stories filmed with a strong documentary sensibility. Robert Young's early films include several award-winning television documentaries, including Sit-In, about sit-ins blacks were staging to protest segregated lunch counters, and a documentary on Angola rebels made in 1961. His film Cortile Cascino, on life in the Sicilian slums, was not shown because NBC felt it was too powerful for broadcast. Unfortunately, with the exception of One Trick Pony, which starred Paul Simon, and another feature, Rich Kids, Young's films do not fit well into easy distribution patterns. This is the case with The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez, which has received lots of great reviews, but so far no theatrical showing in the Philadelphia area, although expected soon the film will probably be released in the town. The Neighborhood Film Project, which is sponsoring the Robert Young retrospective, had planned on premiering Gregorio Cortez, but due to changes on the part of the distributor, the film will not be available. Because of schedule changes, I would recommend that you call the Neighborhood Film Project to check on times and film titles. Tonight at 7:30, however, I can assure you that Short Eyes will be shown, and Robert Young will also speak. The festival is part of the International Cinema Program at International House and continues on 5 different nights through October 19th. International House is located at 37th and Chestnut Streets, and their phone number is 387-5125. That's 387-5125. Well, welcome to Fresh Air. It's I could actually go on and on because you've made many more films than I've mentioned, many of them being documentaries or films based on true stories, and tending, as I had said, to deal with the lives of people who find themselves dispossessed or oppressed, minorities. What do you think attracts you to making films in that style about those type of lives?
Well, I'm obviously attracted to those people. I strongly identify with them. I'm interested in the stories that I haven't seen on the screen so far, and a lot of them are stories that are about that are very close to us, about the way we live. And I guess part of this also comes from my early life spent as a documentary filmmaker, where I've lived with Eskimos, and I've lived with across the Kalahari Desert with desert bushmen, and I spent 4 months living with the Maasai following a wildebeest migration, and I've lived with on an American Indian reservation and lived in a Navajo hogan for a month and traveled across the Southwest picking onions, and not for too many days, I must confess, but living with a Chicano family of migrants. And I guess always been attracted to these lives of other people who were different from me, but in the end our sensibilities were so similar, obviously, that I got to care about them and want to tell their stories. Nothing But a Man, for example, which is a film that Michael Romer and I made, and it came out in 1964, had its origins in time spent in 1960 in Fayette County, Tennessee, and in Mississippi during the beginning of the sit-in movement. And the people I met, who I thought were extraordinary people, were the people who I, you know, were people who were, I found attractive and who I wanted to make my film about.
One of the film, well, in fact, the film being shown tonight at International House at 7:30, Short Eyes, takes place in the Tombs Prison in New York, and it's based on a play, but nevertheless mm-hmm. has a very strong, real feeling to it because it actually takes place in that prison. Could you tell us a little bit about the story and what you did before filming to get a sense of making a film that would portray prison life?
Right. Well, let me try and tell you about Short Eyes, because That's quite a story. First of all, Short Eyes is really the work of Miguel Pinheiro. I mean, I'm the film director, but I have to honor him. He's the one whose experience it was. As a matter of fact, when I started to... The origin of Short Eyes, it actually got started by somebody else. I don't want to talk about who it was, but the way the project happened, I think, does say something about filmmaking and what this business is like. And I suppose people listening are interested in who are interested in film would find it interesting. Miguel Pinheiro had been offered a lot of money for the rights to Short Eyes, and he turned it down because he didn't want he wanted the part of the main character played by a Puerto Rican. And he was afraid that a Hollywood star would play the part, and he was afraid that he would somehow lose control of his work. And so he never sold it. But then he fell on hard times, as was something that often happened to Miguel, and somebody got the rights to Short Eyes for a much, you know, a more modest price. And they went to a record lawyer, reputable man, but someone who had figured in the success of Superfly, and Superfly was a movie, a black film that made lots of money, particularly on its record. I think it made millions of dollars on the record.
Isaac Hayes, right?
With Curtis Mayfield's music. And so this person who had the rights to the story went to the lawyer and said, look, here's a vehicle, Short Eyes. And they got together with the idea that they would raise the money and make this film and sort of like do it as a quickie, and then they would have a great record sale, and Curtis Mayfield's music soundtrack would be on it, and they'd have another Superfly. That was the kind of thinking that really motivated it. And this other person started directing the movie. They actually started in the Tombs, cast it, started, and they shot for 5 days. And then the cast told him, this man, that if he came back on Monday, they'd kill him. And they meant it. I mean, you know, some of these guys had been in the joint for just exactly that crime. And he didn't come back on Monday, and the whole production stopped, and that was it. And they were desperate, and that's when two of the people in the crew had worked with me before, the director of photography and the gaffer, and they'd recommended me. And so Miguel Pinheiro came up and saw a piece of a film I was making called Alambrista. And when he saw parts, he saw about 20 minutes of it, and he said, this guy is going to direct the movie. And that's how I came into it. And when I came into the situation, I saw that there was really no... The script was the play, which had been bastardized, because there were some scenes that had been added to the play that really took the play outside of the prison and introduced a lawyer and some things that these people had insisted on, and they clearly didn't work. So what I said was, look, you don't really have a script. What we have to do is you have to wait a couple of months, write a script, and then start all over. And they wouldn't do that, and I began to realize the reason they wouldn't do that was because if they didn't continue, almost immediately they'd lose the money. So it was a really tricky situation. So what I did was, I wanted very much to do the film because I loved them. I had never seen the play, but I read the play. And from meeting Miguel, I mean, I knew I had to do this. And so I bought 2 weeks. I kept pushing them off. They wanted me to shoot the next day each time. And during that 2 weeks, we recast the play, the film, and made a lot of changes in it. And tightened the script so that it began to come down toward a screenplay, but by no means finished doing that.
Well, you spent a good deal of time actually in the Tombs and in the part of...
In the Tombs, but I never was able to do research for that film. I found out some important things on this film. I mean, what I like to do is to be able to live the life that I'm going to be filming, so I really understand people's behavior. And I wanted to go and spend time at the Brooklyn House of Detention where Miguel had where he'd written the story, but they wouldn't allow Miguel to go to visit because he'd been a prisoner there. They wouldn't allow him back as a visitor. And I could have gone for a few days. I had very little time. But it seemed to me that if I went, it would make a statement to Miguel that I didn't trust, that I had to see everything myself, you know? And so I made the decision on the spot that I wouldn't go, but here I had all of these people. I had Miguel, I had other guys who had been in the joint, who had spent years in jail, and I could go into their imagination. And what I've found is that your whole life is what's preparing you. It's not just the preparation, the specific preparation, you know, like of being in a jail, but it's your life. And then, of course, then I went into their heads to try to find out the specifics of the behavior.
Well, in terms of those specifics, what were some of the details that you wanted to be sure to be able to convey in your film so that the audience would have a sense of that prison experience?
Well,
you know, in terms of what's written on the walls.
Yeah, let me say, I certainly wanted to render the physical experience of men isolated, you know, in cages like beasts, and to see them that way. But the most important thing was really getting at it psychologically, because that's what the medium really is. I mean, it's a psychological medium. You don't get hot from seeing a film about the desert, and you don't get cold seeing a film about the Arctic. But when Charlie Chaplin is about to sit down on a hypodermic needle, you wince. You know, it's taking. So I knew that what I had to do was create a world of experience, of situation. And so what I tried to do in Short Eyes, which of course was a play, where there were a limited number of characters, and which had been designed very frontally, you know, because so it would be presented from a proscenium arch. Stage, you know, to an audience. So what I try to do is to, like, push all of the characters back into life, destroy the simple look of it, in a sense. In other words, I have to find the arc of every person's life, what he's doing before he comes on the stage and what he's doing after, and involve him in a whole network of a fabric of relationships and that have real texture and that have real facts to them, like drug dealing in the joint, things that surface in the play, I in the movie try to actually make a physical reality out of, and then so one character isn't waiting for another character to end a speech and then talking, but he is compelled to answer the guy, but while he's answering him, he's also playing cards at the Puerto Rican table and watching that nobody's taking from the pot, you know. You have to make that kind of reality.
Was there any special challenge to directing a cast which included both professional actors and ex-convicts?
Well, it was a exciting challenge. I mean, the cast was brilliant. I mean, the actors were just wonderful, wonderful actors. Sadly, a lot of them haven't had any other chances. To do anything, you know. That's, as a matter of fact, was partly why they threatened that other director, because it's so. These were people who were rendering their own lives, who in their history, you know, here was their opportunity to finally do something beautiful, something that could stand outside of them, that they could point to proudly, and you know, this I did this, I created this character, and Miguel wrote it and. But I also brought my life to it.
Was there much that was corrected by people who had spent time in jails that maybe you didn't have as much of a perception of?
Oh, all the time. All the time. I mean, directing is not... I mean, I think, at least I think, if people think directing is like just telling people what to do, they're very, very wrong. I mean, for example, we would do something and somebody would slam his book down on this table, and then one of the guys would say, "Hey, that couldn't happen because he's black and that's the Puerto Rican table." He would have permission. I find that, so I never would violate anything, any of those realities, on the physical or psychological level, because I think as soon as you do, you're really warping things that are much deeper. I think even the simplest things go very, very deep. You know, I mean, just like the shape of a person's a face. I mean, everything, you know, your body shape, the way you walk, the way you talk, who you are. I mean, all is reflective of things that are deep inside of you. And when you start changing, and those are the things that the audience reads. And if I start giving some of the wrong clues or are not careful about that, then I'm really misdirecting the audience, and I can't make believe with verve that, you know, that I'm papering over something and it doesn't mean anything, because it all means a great deal.
How did audiences react to the film?
Well, audiences reacted tremendously strongly to Short Eyes. As a matter of fact, in Philadelphia, it opened here, and it did sensationally well in Philadelphia. But the film, people were frightened about the film. In New York, one very well-known New York critic, whose name I won't mention, wouldn't go to see it. He was afraid, like. It's a strong film. And yet, the thing that I loved about making the film and feel so strongly about the film is it's about violence but it's all psychological. You do see some violence in the film, but very little. It's actually the anticipation, the fear of the violence that gets to be overwhelming.
Well, it's also a film which I understand provokes audiences to really vocally talk back to it and react.
Yes, well, I remember seeing the film at the Paramount Theater in New York, and the theater had been like turned into the day room. There were a number of people in the theater who vocalized, who spoke to the characters in the screen. And that happened at all the screenings. It was just absolutely incredible. And I know that at first I was sort of like put off for a moment, but only for a moment, because, you know, basically I like everybody to be quiet so I can really get involved in the movie. But I found that it was incredible. It was like what I would imagine, although I've never been there, obviously, but maybe Elizabethan theater might have been like that.
Well, Short Eyes will be the film that's shown tonight at the International House, and the screening is at 7:30, and my guest, Robert Young, will be there to speak at the screening of Short Eyes. And again, this is the first of a 5-part Robert Young retrospective at International House as part of the International Film Series. There have, unfortunately, been some changes due to distribution plans, so that one of the films, Robert Young's most recent film, The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez, will not be shown as scheduled. However, if you'd like to call International House, I can give you a phone number. That's 387-5125, 387-5125, to find out all the information you need to know about the films which will be shown during the Robert Young retrospective. And again, the film we've been discussing, Short Eyes, will be shown tonight at 7:30. Another film, and this may be the film which has gotten the most notice. I'd be curious to hear from you if you'd agree. Another film which you've directed is Nothing But a Man, which starred Ivan Dixon and Abby Lincoln, and it was set in the early 60s in the South.
I'd like to first say that I didn't direct it.
Oh, okay.
Michael
you can clarify
Romer,
that.
Michael Romer directed that. Maybe I can clarify that. Why it's thought of. It's a film, I would say, that's thought of as our film, because Michael and I wrote the story together, and we produced it together. We initially were going to direct it together, but that doesn't really work. Mike directed it. Mike directed the actors. I directed the camera, and that's how we did it.
How did the story develop, and what type of thinking and visiting did you do before the production began to get a sense of portraying racism in the South?
Right. Well, I have to backtrack just a little bit to tell you how the story started, because it started. Mike and I made a film for NBC White Paper that was not aired. It was a film that was a film that meant a great deal to us, about the lives of the very poor in Palermo, Sicily. And they just decided it wasn't what they wanted to show. And the film got taken away from us. We didn't physically have the film. We couldn't show it to anybody. And it was what we considered to be our best work. And it was a very, very frustrating and humiliating kind of experience to find that the thing that you cared about the most and the work that you made was no longer available to you. I mean, you couldn't even show it. And the things that you'd develop, aside from your responsibility to the people who you'd made the film about, because we were hoping our film would change some serious situations in Palermo. But aside from that, our own egos, you know, our development as filmmakers, we'd made this, what I think was a beautiful film, and now we couldn't even show it, and we couldn't learn from it in a way. It was taken away. So we vowed we were not going to we were just going to make our own films from now on, and we were going to make something that no one could take away from us. So it had to be a story film. It had to be something that we raised the money for. It couldn't be somebody else's money. You know, I mean, we couldn't go to a company, and nobody would have given us money anyway. We had to do something that it was ours. And since I had been in the South and making a film called Sit-In, I had met remarkable people who just affected me tremendously. And standing up in the South, both blacks and whites, but essentially black people. And I thought they were just extraordinary people. And it seemed to me at that time that the leading edge of life in America was what the leading edge of where things were happening was in the Deep South. And these people who were standing up, I thought, were the ones who were going to renew our country. And that I felt deeply that if we didn't heal, you know, the deep divisions in between us as a people, that, you know, that we weren't going to make it. And but that in this conflict and reconciliation seemed to me an enormous, enormous promise for what we were as a people and who we could become. So coming out of a situation where we'd stood up for our own film and had it taken away from us, and wanting really to, like, bomb Rockefeller Plaza, but you know, that doesn't solve anything. We went south on a kind of underground railroad made up of the people who I'd met on Sit-In, who passed us deeper and deeper into the South from one family to another. And we traveled, you know, and we the backwoods cabins and you know, the homes of school teachers and farmers and preachers and funeral parlor owners and all kinds of people, and went from South Carolina, moved all the way down to New Orleans, seeing people, talking to them, finding out how they lived, and writing the story for Nothing But a Man.
What was your sense of the people that you talked to? What was their vision of the film that you were going to make? What did they want to see you do?
Oh, that'd be hard for me to say, Danny, and in terms of to remember what they wanted. I mean, I think people were very cooperative. We must have... It's interesting when you sort of turn around and now you're putting me in their shoes, looking at these two white guys, you know, who must have seemed a little bit odd, coming into, let's say, a sharecropper's cabin, and where no white person had ever been, other than to collect a quarter a week or for insurance money, you know, and then not going inside, but just coming to the edge of the porch. I found nothing but tremendous hospitality and warmth, and I'm thinking right now and smelling, cornbread that people made for us, and hominy grits and pork and, you know, good soul food and stuff. And sitting around in people's houses with the kids in our laps and all around us and just listening to them talk and them asking us questions and talking about, you know, our own experiences, and not so much talking about what the film would be. We'd just be talking about people's lives and trying to find out. And there were things that we found out that made up the film.
Well, within the film, there's something of a dialogue of political perspectives of how one should assert themselves as a black man in the South.
I wouldn't put it in terms of shoulds, okay? I mean, I'm just stopping you right on that, because I want to say that Nothing But a Man is not a film that, like all of my films, it's not a film that's trying to tell you something. I don't believe in that myself. What it tries to do is to take you into people's lives and to play the facts. Now, facts are very hard to find out, but to play the facts of people's lives, and by that I mean like in Nothing But a Man, it's a story of a black man who's on a railroad gang, who's living as if he's free, because he's on a railroad gang and he makes $80 a week, which in 1962 was pretty good for a black man in the South, and he's traveling along but where does he you know, when he's off work, he goes to bars and the women he sees are, you know, it's cheap relationships, essentially. not going to put down any roots, and he's moving on. And he finally meets a woman who is, he meets a woman who's a school teacher. And she's attracted to him because he's a guy who hasn't had to knuckle under in a town. So he seems, he's a guy who's kind of like free. But he really isn't free, obviously, of course. He's limited. But he's always in his circle of guys, of railroad workers, Gandhi dancers, he is like a free man in a sense. He's preserved himself. And so she's attracted to him, and he's attracted to her. And she's a woman who's educated. And we'd found out in the Deep South and in the 60s that was the situation. Men, if you were a black family, it was your daughter you'd send off to school if you could send somebody off to school, because there weren't jobs for educated black men. And authority figures like school teachers were women. And that was part of the whole system. And so that's when I say playing the facts are in the lives of these people, and a story embodies these facts. And without my trying to tell you anything about that black men can't get jobs, but black ladies can as school teachers, in the story it all comes out as in terms of situation. That he falls in love and they get married, and there are a lot of other things to the story, but it's about they're trying to settle down in this little town. And then all these things happen, and the relationship turns in on itself. The frustrations of his life and the difficulties he has make actually the relationship, hurt.
Well, the film was shot in southern New Jersey, I understand. Were there any hostilities directed towards the crew or the actors?
We shot actually below the Mason-Dixon line in southern New Jersey, but we did some of the film in Alabama and Mississippi, but not with the cast. I mean, I went down there by myself and shot the opening scenes, and I shot some stuff in little towns, but I got run out of places. And in 1963, that would not have been a good idea to try to go with an integrated crew into Alabama and Mississippi and make a film like Nothing But a Man.
Do you recall if there was much discussion on the set between the actors just about the politics of the day and the different approaches which were being thought of as having merit in fighting for civil rights?
Oh, sure, there was talk. But, you know, one of the great marches on Washington took place during the film, and some of the people from the film went down to it to participate in it, and Mike and I couldn't go because we were so busy working on the movie. But I would say that essentially what we were interested in was not, sure, I'm interested in civil rights, obviously, but what I wanted to do, but me as a person, as a filmmaker, and Mike, I think I'm speaking for him as well, what we were interested in were people. The thing that most exciting about Nothing But a Man, and most extraordinary, it seems to me, was that when that film came out, people in 1964, people were surprised. I mean, I know this for a fact because I heard them say it. White people were surprised to see black people acting like people in their living rooms, in their bedrooms, in their kitchens. I mean, just seeing normal human life. That was the thing that was astonishing about it to them. And I'm not interested in making myself turning things into issues. I don't think film is slight. You know, film is big and powerful, but it's only, look, what, 2 hours? I don't think it has any answers. I think the best that I can do is try to take people into some kind of an experience that, and try to be as truthful and honest as I possibly can, so I'm fair to them. And I wear my who I am on my sleeve, in a sense. In other words, I'm not going to be preachy. I'm not trying to tell them something. I'm not going to be condescending to them. I'm like they are. I want to take them into some kind of experience that will put them in touch with who they are and with the world the way it really is, as much as we can, as I can understand it, that's as much as I know how to do, and then let them think about it, but not to tell them something. I don't have any answers.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with film director Robert Young. Tonight at International House, there will be the beginning of a retrospective of his films and a screening of Short Eyes at 7:30 with Robert Young in person, who will be there to speak. And the film we've just been discussing, Nothing But a Man, will be screened on Wednesday, the 19th of this month, also at 7:30 at International House. For more information, you can call 387-5125. Your most recent film, The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez, will hopefully be opening soon in Philadelphia.
Yes, I think it'll open here sometime this month.
I should make a note for listeners who are expecting to see it as part of the International Cinema Program. Unfortunately, due to a change on the part of the distributor, that film will not be shown. Rich Kids will be shown in its place, and that's later on this week when that will be shown. But in the hopes that The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez will soon be in Philadelphia, could you tell us a little bit about what interested you in the story and how the film came about?
Oh, absolutely. The story is based on a very famous series of songs, corridos, that celebrate the adventures of Gregorio Cortez. And Gregorio Cortez was a real man who lived in South Texas in the border area. Was born before in the late 1800s. And this story takes place in 1901. I think it started on June 11th, as a matter of fact, and when a sheriff and his interpreter came out to the ranch where Gregorio Cortez was living to question him about a horse trade that he was reported to have made. And they were looking for a horse thief and they were suspicious it might have been Gregorio Cortez. And there was a misunderstanding when they went out to visit him. I don't want to give too much of it away, but out of the misunderstanding, Cortez's brother was killed and the sheriff was killed. And then Cortez fled. And he was surrounded in another place, a friend's place. And there was an ambush and he escaped. But a number of two other sheriffs were killed, and a number of Mexicans who were in the house were wounded, and this led to the biggest manhunt in Texas history. There were sometimes as many as 600 men in the field after Gregorio Cortez, and his gang. That's what they said. All the papers said at first. They were convinced that it was a gang of horse thieves that had been terrorizing this part of Texas, and people were really on the lookout for him. There was a train that was mobilized that ran down to the border area so that the Texas Rangers could ferry fresh horses up and down the line. And when there would be reports of like he'd been sighted or part of the gang had been sighted, they could run the train below that point, and then they could, with fresh horses, they could intercept and try to stop him before he got to Mexico. So it was a chase story, which is in itself exciting, but way beyond that, it's a fascinating, complex story. I saw it as an opportunity to take people into an experience where they themselves will make the misunderstanding, where they themselves will become impatient about this bandito they're following for three quarters of a movie. And then finally, there'll be a revelation that they'll be very surprised about.
Was there anything that struck you as you learned the history of Gregorio Cortez and all the surrounding history of his family and the context that the people around there lived? Because as you were saying, you do try to get into the lives of the people around which you're filming.
Well, what I did on Cortez, I tell the story from an Anglo perspective. I wasn't interested in making a film that could be thought of or felt to be some Anglo-liberal, you know, making a film about some poor Mexican who suffered an injustice. I mean, I think that'd be a condescending kind of movie. No one would like it. Everyone would feel they're being preached to. No one would go to see it, and it would be a bad movie. And it wouldn't get at the dynamics of it anyway. What interested me was taking you into 1901 Texas, into a portrait of who these people are and who we are, because even though you're making a film about 1901, I mean, it's about us, you know? You can't just go back to 1901 as hard as you try. And we tried very hard. It's a very authentic kind of movie in its look. But still, You know, we're looking at it from our sensibilities of 1983. And I wanted to make this portrait of us as a people.
In making a narrative feature, a film which is going to have to be successful on a commercial film release level, but still it's based on a true story, do you find you had to compromise anything in terms of the facts of the story or the character portrayal, how the personalities work? So, what were your guidelines?
That's an interesting question. That's an interesting question. Because you really do have to change. You cannot tell the whole story. I mean, just patently, now I'm going to say something that's really, of course, like so obvious it's stupid, but it gets at the point. I mean, you'd have to really like relive the entire time, you know, 24 hours a day, be every place. You can't obviously do that. I'm sorry, I have this cold.
It's okay. Why don't I reintroduce you for people that are just tuning in, that I'm speaking with Robert Young, whose latest film, The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez, will open in Philadelphia, hopefully sometime in the next month. This week will be a 5-night film retrospective of Robert Young, and it's actually running through October 19th on 5 separate nights at the International House. It's part of the International Cinema Series, and you can call 387-5125 to get more information about that. And we were talking about how...
I can try and answer your
question.
Yeah,
you know, the changes you have to make in taking a true story and making a narrative out of it.
Right. So since you can't replicate life, and of course that would be quite... it's impossible and it would be stupid anyway, what we go to a dramatic structure because, and in film, we're going to a particular medium that's very abstract. When I say it's abstract, it's because you're seeing surfaces of reality, brief little surfaces that are cut against, juxtaposed against other surfaces, that start to give you a sense of a whole environment. And so what you have to do is judiciously pick the elements. You're making like little models is what you're making. And what you're leaving out is as important as what you're putting in. Because the way you see things in life, it seems to me, like you see me at this occasion, you get one view of me. And if you saw me with my children, you saw me with my wife, you'd get other views. You know, you might be very critical of me and seeing me in some other situations. But then there's the ambiguities, you know, between people. I mean, between these different views. So the trick is to find make these little situations that contain the dynamics of what you perceive to be the truth. But it's always what one thinks is the truth, of course. So, and then to bring it down to something that's less than 2 hours, there are compromises you have to make. I mean, for example, there's a wonderful character, Frank Fly, who's a true character, who was the sheriff in charge of the posse of the chase. And he also turns up at the end, and he protects Cortez when there's a lynch mob comes to the jail. Now, the chase had a number of different posses with different sheriffs following them at different times, and I combined a number of those and gave them all to Frank Fly. Otherwise, I would have had to introduce 4 or 5 different sheriffs. It would have been incomprehensible.
Well, I'm sure there are many people awaiting the opening of the film in Philadelphia. I had a chance to see it outside of Philadelphia, and I liked it very much. And I'd like to thank you very much for being here today on Fresh Air.
Oh, I'm delighted. I'm sorry that I'm having this frog in my throat.
That's okay. We still had a chance to hear about your films, and I appreciate it again, your time today on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
And if you would like to see the films of Robert Young, tonight is the beginning of a retrospective of his work at International House, which is located at 37th and Chestnut. Tonight at 7:30, there'll be a screening of Short Eyes, a film about the prison life in the Tombs Prison in New York, and Robert Young will be there in person to speak. That's at 7:30 tonight. Other films include Rich Kids, Curtillo Cascino, Sit-In, Alambrista, and Nothing But a Man. This will be on 5 separate nights through October 19th. There has been a schedule change. The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez will not be shown as part of the series, but you should call International Cinema at the International House at 387-5125 to find out about the schedule of the Robert Young retrospective. Thanks again for being here today on Fresh
Thank
Air.
Thank you, Danny, very much.
It's about 16 minutes to 4 o'clock, and you're listening to Fresh Air on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. A little bit after 4 o'clock, Terry Gross will be back, and she'll be speaking with Richard Stolle, who is the former managing editor of People magazine and now is the managing editor of Life magazine.